I'm not holding bake sales. I'm going to people who can donate large amounts of money and asking them to donate.
Big ad money pours into Alaska to influence the race for Mark Begich's Senate seat. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, December 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new report on officer-involved shootings in Anchorage.
The data is conflicting and the numbers are tiny. And I think to try and draw sweeping conclusions based on that is taking issues out of context.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
Outside money is expected to pour into the race for the U.S. Senate seat held by Mark Begich, and the first of it is making a splash across Alaska's TV sets. Last month, it was an anti-Begich ad from Americans for Prosperity, a group linked to conservative billionaires David and Charles Koch. Now, a pro-Begich super PAC is weighing in with an ad of its own. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Alaskans can expect a lot more in the months to come.
The anti-Begich ad featured an unnamed woman with long reddish hair in a kitchen, tying Begich to the Affordable Care Act.
Senator Begich didn't listen. How can I ever trust him again?
The new TV spot also features a woman with long reddish hair, also in a kitchen, but her name appears on screen. She's Megan Cawley of Anchorage.
That ad attacking Senator Begich, turns out she's an actress from Washington, D.C., pretending to be from Alaska. I'm not an actress. I live here. And I trust Mark Begich. He's trying to fix the health care law.
The message is the first public appearance of a super PAC called Put Alaska First, which spent nearly $100,000 on it. Its treasurer is Anchorage lobbyist Jim Lotzfeld.
Honestly, we weren't planning on coming out this early, but it's clear in 2014 politics across the nation that Koch brothers are on an attack, and we thought it was smart to start our defense.
While his ad emphasizes its Alaska bona fides, Lotzfeld acknowledges he's paying for it with out-of-state money.
I'm not holding bake sales. I'm going to people who can donate large amounts of money and asking them to donate.
He says he'll disclose the donor list when he's required to in January. But he says the six-figure spending he's reported so far came from just a few people. Super PACs like his, along with so-called dark money groups that don't have to name their donors, are sure to be a multimillion-dollar force in Alaska's Senate race. Unlike a candidate's campaign, these groups can raise unlimited amounts of money from anybody, corporations, unions, or just rich people who want to influence the makeup of the U.S. Senate. But they can't contribute to candidates, and they can't coordinate their strategy with a candidate's campaign. Super PACs have formed to support Republican Senate candidates Mead Treadwell and Dan Sullivan, too, but they haven't reported any of their spending yet. To get an idea of how much money these sort of groups can inject in a race, take a look at Montana. 2 years ago, about $55 million was spent on the U.S. Senate contest there, more than half of it by outside groups. Montana political science professor David Parker says the Alaska race is likely to attract a flood of outside money for the same reasons Montana did. To start with, they both have small populations, so TV time is cheaper than in big city media markets.
So number one is the cost of advertising. A lot of bang for your buck.
Also, Parker says the Senate's political landscape is much the same this time. It's closely divided between the parties, and nationwide, Parker sees only 5 or 6 seats on the ballot that could go either way, to a Republican or a Democrat.
So if you're trying to swing the balance of power nationally, you go to the competitive seats, and guess what? Alaska's one of them. So why do these outside groups care? It's not so much about Alaska issues, but the broader national implications of the balance of power in the United States Senate.
Professor Parker says the ads Alaskans are starting to see are only the most visible of the political spending. Outside groups spent millions in Montana on the ground war. These weren't your standard door-knocking, get-out-the-vote campaigns. Parker says they used, among other tools, statistical modeling, crossing, for example, poll results with consumer purchase histories to micro-target.
And they'll look for trends out of their sample and say, hey, I know these people who drink Folgers crystals, whatever, are more likely to have this argument about Mitt Romney resonate with them. So they find all the people who drink Folgers crystals, and they send targeted messaging and people to the doors to give them that message in person.
Alaskans, he says, can expect much the same. If the spending in the Alaska race reaches Montana proportions, it would amount to more than $200 per likely voter. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The University of Alaska Anchorage Justice Center presented findings today from a study about officer-involved shootings in Anchorage. The study was an attempt to show the recipe for the cases when officers open fire on suspects, but it produced conflicting data. One thing that did stand out in the study is that in many cases, the suspects who are shot use vehicles as weapons. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
After 2 years of high-profile officer-involved shootings in Anchorage, including one of a Pacific Islander man armed only with a stick, the Anchorage Police Department commissioned the study from the University of Alaska Anchorage Justice Center. Researchers caution the study deals with small numbers, just 45 shootings in two decades, and that much of the data is contradictory. Assistant Professor Dr. Troy Payne reviewed the cases.
We were looking at situational characteristics, officer characteristics, and characteristics of the citizens that were involved in these.
Payne says minorities, particularly African Americans, Native Hawaiians, and Pacific Islanders, are disproportionately represented in officer-involved shootings over the 20-year period. And he says that's not a surprise, because minorities tend to be overrepresented when it comes to just about every aspect of the criminal justice system, from arrest rates to the ability to get bail.
I don't see that as something that is suggestive that APD is racist or has any sort of racial animus, but it is a question, and we should probably be looking at that. It may very well be that people from these communities react differently to the police, and it may be that the police department can engage in training and outreach that could help address that. It may be that these communities need to think carefully about how they're reacting to police officers operating in their neighborhood.
Anchorage Police Chief Mark Muse says the department commissioned the study because of public outcry regarding the spike in officer-involved shootings in recent years. There were five in 2012 and five more in 2013.
Those two events back-to-back got the police department and the public and the media all talking about what, if anything, has changed in this town. What, if anything, is changed with the police department? And we committed to doing a number of things. One of those things is to take a good hard look into what we think is going into these officer-involved shootings, what we could learn, what sort of changes we could make, what sort of changes the public needs to make.
Last spring, the APD decided to stop firing at vehicles and to institute new tactics for dealing with cars when they're being used as weapons. Muse says the study confirms that was the right decision, showing that in 40% of officer-involved shootings, the weapon was a car. A fact sheet recently produced by the UAA Justice Center says assaults on officers have gone up over the past decade in Alaska, and the shift in tactics at APD, he says, is an effort to address that. But Muse says, in general, it's hard to get much clarity from the study.
The data, on one hand, says that certain minorities are overrepresented. There's other data that would suggest that minority officers shoot more. There's other data that says that most of the people we shoot are white. The data is conflicting and the numbers are tiny. And I think to try and draw sweeping conclusions based on that is taking issues out of context. And I don't want to see the community divided over that.
Dr. Payne researched which minorities were shot most often during the first decade, and he found that most were black males. But over the past 10 years, that group has been replaced by Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander males. The family of Shane Tossey, the Pacific Islander man who was shot and killed while wielding a stick last year, is suing the Anchorage Police Department. His is the only case over the 20-year period where someone was shot for using a blunt object as a deadly weapon. Muse says another study is in the works that will look at cases in which officer-involved shootings didn't happen. Both studies will be updated annually, and eventually the APD hopes to use the information to prevent officer-involved shootings. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
About one-third of officer-involved shootings in the study resulted in citizen fatalities. The APD plans to, for the first time, publish their policies, including those concerning officer-involved shootings, in 2014. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the yearly holiday party at the governor's mansion.
She knows this house is the cookie house, not the governor's house. And she loves seeing the gingerbread houses and the train.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The Department of Administration has a new acting commissioner. Curtis Thayer has been promoted from his deputy position, and he will be taking over for Becky Haltberg, who left the position for a job with the State Hospital Association. In the past, Thayer has worked for the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and for the utility NSTAR. While at the Department of Administration, Thayer has helped implement a policy of universal space standards, which put most state workers in 6x8 cubicles. Government figures show 398 Alaskans signed up for private health insurance during the first 2 months of the online marketplace. The federally run site that provides access for individuals to shop for insurance to help meet requirements of the new health care law has been marred by glitches since its October 1st launch. Prior figures released by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services showed 53 Alaskans signed up during the first month of enrollment. In 36 states, including Alaska, which has relied on the federally run site for access, about 137,000 individuals had selected plans as of November 30th. More than 227,000 people signed up in states running their own sites. Open enrollment runs through March, but December 23rd is the deadline to enroll for coverage beginning January 1st. A coalition of fisheries-related businesses is holding a public forum in Anchorage tonight on House Bill 77. The controversial legislation would streamline permitting for the Department of Natural Resources. Earlier this week, people packed into the Borough Assembly Chambers in Soldotna for a meeting on the issue. As KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports, not one member of the public testified in favor of the bill.
Testimony went on for more than 2 hours. Everyone who stepped up to the mic was opposed to the bill, a level of agreement rarely seen in this room. Two major issues surfaced as sticking points. One was raising the legal standard for challenging a Department of Natural Resources ruling. Joining the panel with Senator Michicki and Fish and Game Commissioner Cora Campbell was Deputy DNR Commissioner Ed Fogles. He explained how that would work.
And it's controversial. When DNR makes a decision, the first step for a member of the public that doesn't like our decision is to do an administrative appeal. They file some paperwork and they appeal it to the commissioner of DNR, and the commissioner has to look at it, and it starts a whole big process for us, right? So we're looking at these appeals, and quite frankly, a lot of them really don't have a lot of merit. People just don't like the decision. They may not even live in Alaska. We're trying to make it so that people have a good reason to appeal a decision.
He says the current qualification for challenging a decision is too broad, and under HB 77, that would change.
This makes it so that you have to write down why this decision will damage you, will harm you. That's the change here. You just have to show us how our decision's going to harm you. It raises the bar for an appeal. Now, I know a lot of people out there just don't fundamentally agree that we should be raising that bar, but it's a way for us to reduce the administrative burden of appeals that don't have merit. Just to keep it so that you have to justify why that decision harms you in some way or another.
The decisions the panel referred to were decisions about water reservation permits called in-stream flow reservations. And what has people worried is losing their ability to save water for fish where it might potentially be used for something else, like a mining project. Fish and Game Commissioner Campbell tried to ease the concern that individuals will lose their standing to apply for or challenge those permits, and that government agencies would instead represent those interests.
Fish and Game has always been very receptive to partnering with people who are interested in securing water reservations to protect fish habitat. We would still be committed to working with interested groups and ensuring that those that share our interest in in-stream flow reservations still have every opportunity to partner with us in obtaining these reservations. So that avenue would still be available to anybody who is interested in continuing to work on these types of projects.
Campbell said the department has already taken 35 applications under its wing that would be disregarded should HB 77 pass, but that wasn't the kind of reassurance the public was after. Dr. David Wortenby, a biology professor at Kenai Peninsula College, told the panel that HB 77 is about trust, but he's not buying the administrative argument that HB 77 will somehow lessen the workload for reviewing permits.
Show me that abuse. I don't believe it, okay? I don't believe it's been abused, and I don't think it's going to happen. The other thing I wonder about is this. Well, we need this streamlining, but you know what? I have a problem with that when you tell me at the very beginning of the meeting that you have resolved more than 70% of the backlog of permits that you're waiting on. It seems to me that internal efficiencies have solved the problems that this entire bill is all about to try and fix. So if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Marilyn Cornell of Soldotna put it even more plainly.
But I'm an Alaskan from the tip of my hair to the bottom of my toes, and nobody should be able to tell me that I don't have a right to put input on anything the state government is going to decide.
Senator Michiki said he had a lot to take back to Juneau after the meeting. HB 77 has already passed the House, and it currently sits with the Senate Rules Committee, which will take up the issue again in January. Reporting from Soldotna, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Normally in December, the Bethel area is covered in snow and ice, but it's been unseasonably warm so far. In fact, Bethel broke a record Friday, reaching 48 degrees. And as KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes reports, it's affecting subsistence gathering.
The YK Delta is known for winter warm-ups, but the amount of them lately has some folks scratching their heads. By now, the Kuskokwim is often a frozen highway of activity for Queefolk residents like Max Olick, who enjoys making the 15-mile trip downriver to Bethel.
You know, this time of the year, we're going back and forth with trucks. But this year, it's kind of depressing.
Olick, who has been a Yupik subsistence fisherman and hunter his whole life, says he's never seen it like this before. Last week, temperatures were above freezing for 6 days straight, reaching into the 40s four of those days. It's enough to melt the snow and turn everything brown, which is not a safe landscape for guys out checking their nets or traps under the ice.
The open leads are hard to see right now, and if you go down to the river, it's all the same. You won't even notice the open waters.
Olick has been the village's public safety officer for 31 years and hasn't crossed the Kuskokwim to check his own net in a week. But others are risking it. Those who have beaver traps or blackfish traps set or whitefish nets under the ice.
They're trying to put food on a table for their family, and, you know, they're risking their life out there and taking chances.
Recently, I know a whole bunch of boats went out to go seal hunting.
About 160 miles away on the Bering Sea coast, Brandon Aguchek works as Skamon Bay's tribal council director. Subsistence seal hunting in December is pretty much unheard of. The season usually wraps up in late October, but everything is melted back to tundra.
Like a fall, early fall.
A lot of hunters in Skamon Bay would normally be out checking their traps and nets this time of year, but Aguchik says they can't. He doesn't know of anyone going hungry. Most have stored salmon and moose and the freshly caught seal, but he says it's still a hardship.
A lot of people rely on whitefish and blackfish and they can't go out and get these things here for their families. So I think some people do have a hard time without checking their traps.
It is getting colder. Although there's no snow in the forecast, freezing temperatures are. Until conditions improve, Max Olick advises against traveling on the river near Bethel. But if you have to, he says don't go alone and bring extra rope. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Matsu Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is looking for input from the public on how best to deal with about 1,000 head of cattle on two islands in the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge. About 200 of the animals are on Woznesensky Island between Sand Point and King Cove, and another 800 are on Chirikoff Island, southwest of Kodiak. The cattle were first introduced to the islands to provide food by a family on Woznesensky in 1938 and for fox ranchers on Chirikoff in the 1880s. Neither island currently has permanent human residents. Steve Delahanty is the manager of the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge based in Homer. He announced the start of a scoping process to comply with the National Environmental Policy Act before the cattle are removed or eradicated.
Not that they're malicious creatures or anything. We need cattle in the world for sure. But in this case, they're consuming the vegetation, altering the vegetation, trampling, compacting the soil. You know, it causes problems for nesting birds, for salmon streams, for archaeological sites that get degraded by the trampling and vegetation removal.
Even though the animals have occupied the islands for up to 130 years, Delahanty says they are still causing damage to them.
So it isn't really a steady state. It's not that they did something back 100 years ago and now everything is fine. The kind of biological potential of the island is at a low level and will remain at a low level until we can bring it up through some sort of action that we want to consider.
Though the cattle far predate wildlife refuges in Alaska, the animals are still considered invasive and not compatible with their environment in the eyes of the federal government.
Congress set them aside and said these places are special and should be managed for wildlife, and so we have an obligation to try and make them available and make them places where wildlife can thrive and people can go out and enjoy that wildlife.
Because of that, it appears allowing the cattle to remain on the islands is a long shot.
We don't have a preferred solution. We have a preferred outcome, which is a healthy refuge islands where wildlife can thrive. But by all means, if people want to say that they think that the best possible outcome is to just leave things as they are now, that is a totally legitimate point of view.
But Delahanty says that if the cattle were to remain and grazing was to continue, it would require a permit and would have to be compatible with the National Wildlife Refuge. The scoping process will include meetings with interested federal, state, and local agencies, federally recognized tribes, stakeholders, and the general public. Russian tea cookies, white chocolate coconut clusters, and star-shaped butter cookies are just a small sampling of what was available yesterday afternoon at the governor's annual Christmas and holiday open house. KTOO's Lisa Fu was at the governor's mansion and has this story.
Doors to the governor's mansion open to the public at 3 o'clock.
And then they're greeted to the governor, First Lady, Lieutenant Governor.
Erica Fagerstrom manages the governor's mansion. She's been organizing the governor's annual Christmas and holiday open house for 8 years. This year, though, is a little more special than others.
They started constructing the house of May 1912, and by December, the family had already moved in, and they had their very first open house, New Year's, 1913. So this is the 100th open house.
After the greetings, guests walk into the dining room, where there is a large table with trays and trays of cookies and fudge. For four-year-old Ella Malaby, this is what she's been waiting for.
She loves it. That was her favorite part, was seeing that whole table full of cookies and candy.
Stacy Malaby brings her daughter to the governor's open house every year.
She knows this house is the cookie house, not the governor's house. And she loves seeing the gingerbread houses and the train.
14-year-old Veronica Salter is with her classmates from Faith Community School. They're performing songs from the musical Christmas in Black and White. Salter can't remember a year she hasn't been at the governor's open house.
I like how everybody is really friendly and how people are singing also, and they play beautiful music. And I like meeting the governor, too. I got to shake his hand and say hello.
Roland Eim is from Germany and is visiting Juneau for the first time. He heard about the event from his daughter, who recently moved to town.
We actually walked for about, a half mile to come here and got very wet, as you can see. And I got a really nice conversation like with the governor.
Eim says he's surprised with the notion of a governor opening up his house to the public.
In Germany or like in France or like any other country, you have lots of police, protecting like the governor, for example. So I think it's a very awesome thing. It's very close to the people, and I appreciate that much, really.
Governor Sean Parnell says continuing the open house tradition is important.
It really says that our government, our house, the people's house is accessible, and it's our chance to be accessible in a pretty big way, and for people to really enjoy the house that belongs to them.
Along with continuing the tradition of the open house, the Parnell family will practice another tradition as they spend the holidays at home in Juneau, opening one gift on Christmas Eve. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shaylin Cochran in Soldotna, Angela Denning Barnes in Kodiak, Jay Barrett, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C., and Alexandra Gutierrez from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline is ready to help you succeed in your decision to quit tobacco. Take advantage of proven successful free resources. Trained quit coaches will provide support services to help you quit for good with confidential counseling. There's free nicotine replacement therapy and a tailored quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Public Education Health Trust, formerly NEA, Alaska Health Plan, delivers cost-effective health plans for Alaska families. They help Alaska's education professionals, from school bus drivers to teachers, manage their health plan benefits efficiently. Public Education Health Trust provides members with low-cost plans, more choices, and local control, advocating for 17,000 Alaskans and their health care needs. This message sponsored by Public Education Health Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.